You're listening to Simpler One Earth Living from Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simple Living Works. This is episode 113 of Simple Living Works with co-hosts Lee Van Ham and Jerry Iverson. Today we feature part one of a conversation with Bill Ryerson of the Population Institute entitled Crises Caused by Exploding Human Population Are Everywhere.
At the very time when species extinctions are happening faster than at any moment since 65 million years ago when dinosaur populations collapsed, one species, Homo sapiens, is in a burst of exponential growth. Now numbering 7.6 billion, our rise to become the overwhelmingly dominant species on the planet carries with it the harbinger of catastrophic decline. Because nature's ecosystems seek balance, no species has ever remained overwhelmingly dominant for long. Theoretically, it is possible that Homo sapiens, having evolved a high level of intelligence, will choose actions that cooperate with nature in reestablishing a balance among species. But current trends indicate that our species will need to be brought back into balance through disaster, disease, and death, just as happens with other species when they have risen to dominate the resources of a region and destroyed the balance of the planet. The multi-Earth worldview is proving to be especially ineffective in dealing with population growth. And why? Well, that's what we're going to be doing in this podcast today, exploring that. Stay with us.
Greetings, Lee, from Paso Robles, California, and Simple Living Works.
And greetings to you, Jerry, from San Diego and Jubilee Economics. So what I just presented before we greeted each other was actually the opening paragraph from the chapter on population and species balance in my book, Blinded by Progress. So as we start this two-part series on human population, it's such a challenging issue that lots of people just don't tackle it. So much denial around this, so much taboo is probably a better word, so much taboo in talking about it. Well, I'm one who says at this point there really isn't any way that we can be stewards of this planet with the top predator, meaning us, continuing to expand numbers and doing so explosively. So that's my basic position. And another paragraph to say a little bit more about how I see this, another paragraph from the chapter I wrote a couple of years ago, our growth rate exceeds our consciousness to even calculate its impact. And all of us, scientists included, are scrambling to come up with a framework in which to discuss this rapid takeover of our planet by our own species. E.O. Wilson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning biologist who's retired now from Harvard, has described this unusually rapid numerical growth by a species of primates, Homo sapiens, as more bacterial than primate. He calculates that human biomass is already 100 times larger than that of any other large animal species that has ever walked the earth. All species, including our own, are reeling from our heavy footprint upon our planet. Well, as I say, that's what I wrote a couple years ago, but that's pretty much where I am right now. I was trying at that point to just delve into this thing of why are we just not able to cope with this explosion of our species? Why can't we exercise some point of control? So that's where I still am, and most essentially I'm saying, you know, feeding 9 billion people, I don't think it's going to come to that. I don't see us being, by our planet, able to allow that with all the species we'd have to displace. So where are you as we begin this topic, Jerry?
Well, thanks for asking, Lee. I wrote an essay recently called Options to Curb the Two Primary Drivers of the Climate Crisis, Overpopulation and Overconsumption. Well, I've worked on the issue of overconsumption for some 25 years. Since circulating the essay for response, I've learned that few people want to touch overpopulation. Not in the progressive church, not among nonprofits, not even liberal politicians. I vowed to carry on this conversation, which began with my interview of John Seeger, head of the Population Connection, formerly Zero Population Growth. By the way, links to my essay and to the earlier episodes are in the show notes. I was introduced to Bill's work when I interviewed Richard Heinberg recently. They're both fellows with the Post-Carbon Institute. Bill focuses on population. That makes sense, since he's the head of both Population Institute and Population Media Center. Bill has distinguished credentials. I hope you'll read his biography. A link is in the show notes. It's my pleasure to speak to Bill Ryerson, the head of the Population Institute and also Population Media. Now, Population Institute, as it says on your website, Bill, is an international nonprofit organization that seeks to promote universal access to family planning information, education, and services. Through voluntary family planning, we strive to achieve a world population in balance with a healthy global environment and resource base. Population Institute was established in 1969 and is located on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. Now, you focus on several elements, including empowering women and girls, and also on preventing poverty. So if you would please tell us a little bit more about the Institute. Just pretend like I know virtually nothing about you and about your various programs.
All right. The Institute is, as you mentioned, almost 50 years old. It was founded 49 years ago by Rodney Shaw. And the purpose behind it was to use various networks that reach large numbers of individuals to help people better understand population dynamics and to address the issue in various productive ways. And by networks, I'm not just talking about broadcast networks, although certainly that was an early part of the Institute's work, but also various organizations with large memberships, youth and student institutions, and other channels of communication such as schools, associations of superintendents, associations of curriculum writers for secondary schools, and so on. And it worked on all of those areas through the decade of the 70s. When I worked full-time at the Institute, I was head of the Youth and Student Division. And during that time, the head of the Communications Center of Population Institute, David Poindexter, discovered the work of Miguel Sabido, a Mexican telenovela producer who had perfected a methodology for using entertainment serialized melodramas for changing social norms on issues like adult education and, when David discovered him, family planning. So, in fact, the whole use of entertainment education that's now carried on by Population Media Center began at the Institute in the 1970s. And David, before working with Miguel Sabido and Televisa, where he was a vice president, had worked in Hollywood, working with people like Mary Tyler Moore and Norman Lear, and Norman Lear's head of drama, Virginia Carter, to influence them to address issues related to status of women, family planning, family size, and similar issues. So, for example, Norman Lear, over dinner one time when I was with him and Lynn Lear at their house in Vermont, told me that when we talked about the storyline related to Maud's abortion that occurred 6 months before the Roe versus Wade decision, Norman Lear responded by saying, "David got Maud pregnant." In other words, that whole storyline was his idea. the vasectomy of Rob Reiner's character in All in the Family, Michael, or people called him Meathead, was David's idea. And the banter on sexism in the workplace by Mary Tyler Moore and the Mary Tyler Moore Show started with David and became so popular that, in fact, Mary Tyler Moore in the 70s wrote a fundraising letter on behalf of the Population Institute. So the Institute then, after Rodney Shaw retired, I left the Institute in 1969 and migrated through two Planned Parenthood affiliates, one in Philadelphia and then the second one in Vermont, and then I got re-involved in working with David Poindexter, who had spun off from Population Institute in the mid-80s and set up Population Communications International. But the Institute, then under the leadership of Werner Fornos, set up a global media award program to recognize news and entertainment media, documentary makers, book authors, and other users of media for accurately addressing the population issue to help inform the global public. And this Global Media Awards now has been going on since the 80s and is quite prestigious for those who win that recognition. The Institute also today, under the leadership of Robert Walker, who's the president, I really serve as chair of the board of the Institute now. And since 2008, the Institute and Population Media Center have been partnered, and Bob Walker has overseen a whole series of interventions related to trying to sustain interest on both sides of the aisle in support for family planning, which has been a tough issue, as you know. And also, the Institute for some time sponsored the Sustainable World Initiative that looked at all of the aspects of sustainability, including population, and worked very closely with the UN in the design of the Sustainable Development Goals. So that initiative was key during the debate about the SDGs. Bob has also published regularly in Huffington Post and other media with op-eds about the importance of maintaining support for family planning. And as issued, he has issued numerous reports on issues such as the war against birth control that the current administration is carrying out, the demographic vulnerability of various countries around the world, and annually the Institute puts out a report card on the 50 states' treatment of family planning, sexuality, education, and related issues. And many of the states now have failing grades on these report cards because of unnecessary regulations they put into effect on family planning provider organizations and on restricting sexuality education to abstinence-only education, which has been demonstrated to be ineffective, but is believed by some to be the only moral approach to educating people is just telling them to say no. So at any rate, the Institute is continuing to do a lot of good, both in terms of policy issues and in terms of public awareness issues, and has also influenced a number of people like Nicholas Kristof to address these issues in their widely read op-eds in the New York Times. So the Institute remains a very important organization and unique among organizations that address the population issue.
Indeed. And you have a relatively new outlet, or you're partnering with another group that puts out a podcast called BrePros Fight Back. Tell us about that.
Yes. Jenny Wetter started this podcast series just in the last year, and They put out regular podcasts with interviews with people involved in primarily policy issues related to reproductive health, family planning, and more broadly population issues. And it's been very well done, and I encourage people to go to populationinstitute.org and link into those podcasts, because there's a lot of very useful information, not all of which is well known. I mean, certainly the Trump administration's attack on family planning is pretty well known, but there are a lot of things going on that have not really gotten much exposure with regard to things like using refugee and illegal alien holding centers to prevent women who legally have a right to have an abortion from getting one. So there have been steps like that taken that have only been stopped in a few instances by lawsuits by the ACLU and other human rights organizations. But now there is a whole major attempt to defund family planning domestically and internationally. And since the U.S. is the largest supporter of family planning assistance worldwide, if that were to happen, it would be catastrophic. What has already happened is defunding of the UN Population Fund, 100% of their U.S. contribution, which was $32 million, has been withheld by the Trump administration. And that alone will lead to increased maternal and infant deaths, as we've seen domestically in the state of Texas, when the Texas legislature adopted unnecessary regulations to force Planned Parenthood affiliates to close. That happened 4 years ago, and since that time, the maternal death rate in Texas has doubled. So these steps are being taken based on a morality which is actually immoral in terms of leading to dramatic increases in maternal and infant deaths.
We'll return momentarily to Jerry's conversation with Bill Ryerson on the crises caused by exploding human population, and these crises are everywhere. Well, let me take a moment here to announce that I'll be traveling in the Midwest at the end of June and early July, so listeners from that area, can we perhaps meet up? I'll be in Chicago area June 26, 27, and 28, and then in Lincoln, Nebraska on July 2 and 3. I have I'll have copies of my books with me to share and sign. The meetings will be about Jubilee Circles and engaging the ecological crises that are taking over the lives of millions of species, including our own. Well, I look forward to talking with some of you and learning from you how you are coping with the overwhelming crises growing around us. More details of where I'm speaking are on the events page of the One Earth Project, and that's the website, The One Earth Project, all one word, .com/events. See the other written, or I'll see the written introduction to this podcast or the show notes to this podcast for those links. So let's return now to Jerry's conversation with Bill Ryerson.
Explain the term fake planning, family planning, because even though funds are being cut off in many states, like in Iowa, to Planned Parenthood, they are still continuing to fund what we generically call fake family planning institutes.
Well, these organizations are basically being funded to commit fraud. They are there to persuade people either not to use family planning or not to have an abortion. So they set themselves up with titles like abortion counseling service, and then when a woman goes there for counseling with regard to an unwanted pregnancy, all they do is lecture her on the importance of not having an abortion and refuse to give any information to her on how she can terminate a pregnancy, even if her health or life is threatened by the pregnancy. So the fact that the federal government is funding organizations to commit fraud is very concerning.
Well, this is a very important topic to me personally. Recently, I wrote a paper and have submitted it to our church assembly, and I want you to critique the basic thesis of this paper, and that is that overconsumption and overpopulation together are the two primary drivers of climate change, or as I call it, climate crisis. Would you agree with that thesis, or am I overstating it?
Certainly, I would agree with the thesis. Population by itself is not 100% of the population of the climate crisis, but it's a significant part. And consumption, of course, is a significant part. So many environmentalists look at the climate situation and say, "Well, you know, the population growth is occurring in poor countries, like in countries in Africa, where" the per capita carbon emissions are pretty low. So really, we shouldn't worry about that at all. We should just worry about overconsumption by people in the U.S. and Europe and Japan, because they're the big emitters on a per capita basis of carbon dioxide. The fault with that view is twofold. One is population growth has occurred in places like China to the point that even with much lower per capita emissions, China emits more carbon dioxide than the United States, and the developing world now emits more carbon dioxide than the developed world. So the other aspect of this is, of course, that people in developing countries want to increase their carbon footprint. They want to lead better, wealthier lives, and that unless their countries manage to somehow decouple energy consumption from carbon emissions, which hasn't effectively happened yet in most places, as these countries develop, as we see with China, the carbon emissions per capita will go up. But even in the poorest countries where the most rapid population growth is occurring, population growth is a major contributor by itself to the climate crisis. For example, I looked at the average developing country per capita emissions and multiplied that by the 2.5 billion people that represent the median projection of additional population between now and 2050. And it came out to roughly the equivalent of adding two United States to the planet. So it's just by itself, population growth in the poorest countries is a climate factor. And Brian O'Neill, University of Colorado Boulder, did a detailed analysis of making a major effort in promoting family planning and small family norms and what that would contribute to averting climate disaster, and he found that it would contribute between 16% and 29% of what is necessary to avoid catastrophic climate change at the lowest cost of any intervention to reduce climate change. So it's not 100%, that is, population is not 100% of the of the climate problem. But it's not zero either, and the fact that the climate conferences have not even discussed population and family planning and daughter education and stopping child marriage and all of these factors that lead to high fertility rates is really sad, because it is an important and inexpensive intervention that can be made in a human rights context to reduce the rate of population growth. And of course, expanding human habitation is the major driver of loss of wilderness and biodiversity. And that is also a major factor in the climate crisis, doing away with rainforests that are the lungs of the world and produce a lot of oxygen and absorb a lot of carbon dioxide. So as these forests are cut down, it is dramatically worsening the climate crisis. and ultimately threatens the habitability of the planet. That may sound extreme, but the point I'm trying to make is that if one visited the planet 3 billion years ago, they wouldn't have survived more than a minute because you couldn't breathe the air, there was no food, the water was filled with toxic minerals, and it's really the evolution of the web of life over the last 3 billion years that has made the planet habitable, and we are systematically destroying that web of life through expanding human habitation and decimation of forests. So it's not just climate that is an indicator that we're living unsustainably, but loss of wilderness and biodiversity, the water crisis, the freshwater crisis, and other issues that are all pointing to the fact that the human enterprise is living way beyond what is sustainable. And when I think about it, I believe that ultimately sustainability is the ultimate environmental issue, it's the ultimate health issue, and it's the ultimate human rights issue. Because if the system collapses, the amount of suffering by people, let alone other species, will be much greater than what we've witnessed in human history. And so it's very important to move us towards sustainability. And when you look at the indicators, for example, on water, the water table of India, which is one of the world's top grain producers, is sinking by about 10 feet a year. And so farmers are having to drill deeper and deeper to get water to irrigate their crops. And when it becomes unreachable economically, their land is turning to desert and the farmers are declaring bankruptcy. And this is happening all across India. And as a result, a lot of lives are at risk. There are about 200 million people in India who are being kept alive by unsustainable overpumping of underground aquifers for irrigation to produce the crops these people are eating. And when that water all disappears, those people will face starvation. China, similarly, many of the rivers of China do not reach the ocean for much of the year because it's all being used for irrigation of crops. And yet the water table of China is sinking by about 3 feet a year. And so China, to offset this, is buying land in Africa and Eastern Europe so they can export the food from that land to feed the Chinese when they run out of water. So we're facing a global food security crisis that at some point may drive the price of food to the point that many of the 2 billion people who live on less than $2 a day will not be able to afford to buy enough food to survive. So we're looking at very serious threats to human welfare and the welfare of all species. And in the face of that, we have an administration in Washington that is hell-bent on cutting off funding for family planning. It just makes no sense at all.
Well, it's considered a moral issue. Abortion is considered a moral issue. For me, overpopulation is a moral issue because, as you say, as the ecosystem implodes, which is bound to do if we continue on this course, then there will be millions and billions of people that will suffer and die because there will not be enough food, air, water to sustain them.
Exactly.
I mean, theoretically, following the model, on the course we're on now, that by 2050 there will be 9 billion people, and then by 2100 there could be as few as 1 billion people because there will be just no way of sustaining that many people.
Yes.
Do you want to critique that thesis?
I think it's a reasonable scenario. Now, having said that, I'm well aware of all the criticism Paul Ehrlich got in 1968 when he forecast a major famine in India in the 70s, only to be surprised by the Green Revolution. When he wrote the book, he did not know of all the work being done by Norman Borlaug to create high-yield wheat and high-yield grains, rice and so on, that revolutionized food production in places like India and bought that country several decades of time to get to address the population issue. And as a result, his forecast was not well timed. Having said that, though, Ehrlich is more pessimistic now than he was in the 60s because the additional time that was bought by the Green Revolution has led to a situation now where, unless there is some other technological breakthrough, we have a much bigger population that's facing this threat of food insecurity than we did in the 70s. I know that a lot of people are developing various kinds of interventions to make irrigation more efficient and to produce energy-efficient devices of all kinds. And so I expect that we will see some additional innovations in the coming decades that will buy us some time. But the basic thesis that Ehrlich put forward in the 60s is still the case, that we cannot have unending exponential growth in human population without facing an ultimate catastrophe, because we have limited resources. And yes, let's figure out how to use those resources as efficiently as possible, but ultimately we will, as a civilization, have to live 100% on renewables. We can't continue to live on non-renewable resources, which by definition are being depleted as they are used. And so as oil, coal, and gas are consumed, as metals and minerals that are taken out of the earth are consumed, they are lost to future generations. And the easy-to-get stuff has already been mined, and now we're going after, for example, with oil, the very difficult, environmentally risky, and very expensive oil to get under the Arctic Ocean and through fracking. But again, that those supplies are being used up, and as they are, the return on investment in oil will continue to go down. In the 1870s, a barrel's worth of energy invested in drilling led to 100 barrels of oil pumped out of the ground. Today, a barrel's worth of energy leads to 3 barrels out of the ground. When it reaches 1-to-1, no matter how much oil is left in the ground, no company is going to spend a barrel of energy to get a barrel out of the ground, and oil production will stop. Hopefully, it'll stop sooner than that, because consumption of fossil fuels is a major driver of climate change. But in any case, before the end of this century, for better or worse, human civilization will almost 100% be dependent just on renewables. And looking at just renewables, some scientists have done some very interesting projections of what number of people could be sustained by renewable resources at a decent quality of life. For example, Cornell biologist David Pimentel did a detailed analysis based on the assumption that people would be living at the Western European lifestyle. And on that assumption, with renewable resources only, the world could sustain 2 billion people. Since we're now at 7.5 billion, we clearly have a problem, unless we want to live far more meager lives. So, you know, maybe 7 billion could be kept alive at the Ethiopian lifestyle. I don't think anybody's done that analysis, because people really want to live healthy, well-fed, and economically comfortable lives. So looking at the data Pimentel put together, it's pretty clear we need to dramatically bring about changes in desired and actual family size and move society to the point that we actually have below replacement level fertility and can bring the population down to a sustainable level before nature forces our hand through rapid increase in mortality rate.
You've been listening to our conversation with Bill Ryerson of the Population Media Center on the crises caused by exploding human population. The early July episode features Bill Ryerson, and that's the next episode that we have of the podcast. Bill Ryerson on the second part of this conversation, it will be entitled Reducing Human Population Through Methods That Work. Have you listened to our recent episodes? In early June, we hosted Bonnie Tarwater, pastor of the Church for Our Common Home. She was talking about new kinds of structures emerging in which the church really connects more profoundly with the earth. In April and May, we hosted economist Susan Taylor of Just Financial Advisors in a three-part series on her new book, What About Our Money? A Faith Response. Very worthwhile book, and I do hope you'll listen to that three-part series. You're sure to pick up thoughts you'll value. We certainly did as we created those episodes.
Please subscribe to my Simple Living Daily Nudge to get quick reminders of Lee's blogs, the Common Good podcast, Simple Living Works podcast, and other intriguing happenings at events, such as Non-Conform Freely celebrations, ways to honor rites of passage and holidays without consumption. Please do share your thoughts on these subjects. Leave a message on the Common Good podcast and Simple Living Works Facebook pages. Well, it's time to wrap up this episode. If you're a regular listener, you've heard our closing comments, so we'll say goodbye now. But if you're a newer listener, here's what we need you to know about the podcast. Please subscribe to our Jubilee Economics, One Earth, and Simple Living Works blogs. We post new nearly every week, so if you're a subscriber, you will be told when we post something new. Subscriptions are free. Subscribe to our blogs through our websites. You can also subscribe to the Common Good podcast and Simple Living Works podcasts at iTunes or your favorite podcast service. Urge your friends to do the same. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works with co-host Lee Van Ham of the Common Good podcast, wishing you well as we strive together to bring simpler One Earth living into being for the common good.
Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live.